www.mediafree.tvpodcastnetwork.
Serial killers like to leave information to taunt and to tease the police. They want to show that they're smarter than the police officers who were on the case.
I am deeply hurt by you calling me a woman hater. I am not, but I am a monster. I am the son of Sam.
The thing about the letter that kind of really opened the door was that he signed it with a name. He is now the son of Sam.
As New York City, quote-unquote, celebrates the 40th anniversary of the capture of David, son of Sam Berkowitz, The Plotter Presents gives Lonnie Diane Rich the quote-unquote gift of Martin Sheen as a grieving widower who is on the case with whales? Is your dog telling you not to bother with that nonsense? Probably, but let's find out. It's episode 18 of The Plotter Presents. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. This is episode 18. I'm your desk sergeant, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am joined by Chipperish Media Chief, Lonnie Diane Rich. Hello.
Hey, Sarah. How are you doing?
I am great. I am so excited that you are our guest today. I am so grateful that you tolerated not one, but two most wanted segments about the son of Sam, because programmers sort of split the difference around when we record. One of the things we're going to talk about has aired already, and one is not airing until this coming weekend, as you're listening to this. But let's begin with the upcoming one, Investigation Discovery's Son of Sam, The Hunt for a Killer. This program is airing Saturday the 5th at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Were you expecting this to be a slog? Because I was.
Well, I wasn't really sure what to expect from all of these, so it was kind of fun going into them. And I actually watched them slightly out of order. The Smithsonian one that we're going to watch, talk about in a little bit, I watched first, and that's just clips, you know, from it. So when I watched Hunt for a Killer, I was like, okay, you know, they're giving it context, they're giving it narration, it's nicely shot, they're interviewing people. So I actually kind of enjoyed The Hunt for a Killer. I thought it was pretty good.
So did I. I thought they did a really good job. There was that cheesy voiceover that we heard in the intro clip, and spoiler, we'll be hearing it again. Someone got loose with the vocoder. I don't know what happened. But I thought it did a really good job laying out a timeline that made it manageable, that sort of hit highlights of facts that you might already have known. But I mean, I was 3 and 4 years old when all of this was going on, and my parents had moved to Jersey to like get me away from stuff like this and the blackout. So I have really no memory of this or, I don't know, anything else. I was 3.
Yeah, I was a kid too, so I didn't know anything about Son of Sam. Like, I didn't hear anything about it until, you know, like late night people would always make the jokes about the guy who's, you know, the dog tells him to kill people. And what's interesting about this is that, like, all of the serial killer cliches, I think, kind of come from Son of Sam, from David Berkowitz. Like, you know, a postal worker, kept to himself, real quiet, you know, dog talking to him and tell him to kill people. Like, the whole thing feels like all of the cliches that we've sort of grown up with in like generic pop culture sort of stem from this one lightning rod.
Yeah, that's really true. And you have to wonder too, how much other serial killers, like, not that they were, you know, creating homages to David Berkowitz with their murders, but like there are certain overlaps, and not just the fact that they're serial killers and monsters. Before we get into talking a little bit about that, because I thought that The Hunt for a Killer did a pretty good job integrating these old detectives who were actually on the case. But first I wanted to talk about that they interviewed a lot of survivors of the attacks and family members, and for an investigation discovery property to sort of figure out how to present their testimony in a way that's not cheesy and manipulative is a sort of leap forward for that network. And I was pleased to see that. Here's a clip of one of the victim's brothers talking about finding her.
By the time I got there, she was already on the pavement outside the car. I checked her for a pulse, and there was nothing I could do. She was dead by the time I got down there.
I mean,
oh God, that was so heartbreaking. That was a really effective moment.
It really was. And he sort of pulls himself back together and continues. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I enjoyed most about both of these Most Wanted properties is how flavorful and New York-y they both were. More the lost tapes, which we'll get to in a second. But here's another clip featuring then Mayor Abe Beame being quite dramatic. But I don't think too dramatic about the effect that Son of Sam has had. And then, unfortunately, there's a little VO at the end in clip three.
During the last few weeks, New Yorkers have been subjected to a series of criminal outrages which are unmatched in recent memory.
Surprisingly, Mayor Beame reveals a critical detail.
It was the mayor that disclosed the caliber of the gun, which we thought was insane.
Right now, if the killer takes that gun and throws it away, the chances are they will never catch him.
So there's the dilemma you always face. The investigators, they want to hold back, but the public has to know.
Let's see how ready you are. You guys have made me very angry. So kiss my ass, all you bitches.
I mean, that clip is sort of, it's everything that the Hunt for a Killer does well and does poorly. That VO is a lot. And I think they could have probably just showed the letters, which are, you know, printed in capital letters and quite easy to read, or just had someone read them without any affect and not been
without the extra echoey kind of thing. Yeah. That was kind of weird because for most of The Hunt for a Killer, they actually do a really good job. They're doing really good quality interview work with these people. They're letting these people speak for themselves. We're seeing historical footage of these detectives, and then we're seeing them now after 40 years and looking back on this, what must have been like this incredibly pivotal experience. And I think it's one of these things where, you know, they're not trusting the audience. They feel like they still need to reach out and throttle, you know, and I don't think that at this point that you really do, because The Son of Sam is an engaging story and you can kind of pull back a little bit. I think when you try too hard, you end up pushing your audience away. And when you pull back a little bit, like if they had just had somebody, and somebody who sounded like David Berkowitz, you know, somebody who had a voice like that rather than like the I am a serial killer monster, like, you know, they had somebody
like
who sort of
shooting
had that.
People. We got it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the brief.
We're engaged. Like, we're already watching this. We're already invested.
Exactly.
You know, like, everybody now has remote controls. If we want to change the TV channel, we've already changed it. Like, the people who are watching are going to be into it. But I thought that they did a really good job of building the narrative. I mean, I'm a story expert. That's what I do. I'm not a true crime person, but I like looking at the way that stories are built. And we have three examples in these three things that we're looking at today, which were fascinating to me from like a narrative perspective. But The Hunt for a Killer actually built that narrative and escalated that narrative really nicely, you know, and built it up, and you felt the tension and everything was getting worse. And then we have this moment where, you know, the mayor gives away a piece of information that's somewhat pivotal. And there was a detective who said, you know, if the guy just throws that 44 away, then we're lost. We're never going to find him. And I mean, the thing is that Berkowitz, I think there's probably a pretty good argument to be made that he wanted to get caught. You know, he's he's one of those classic, you know, serial killers that, and probably because he created the cliche, we created all of our serial killer cliches from this guy. But that he really seemed to want to get caught. And only because of that, you know, did he actually get caught? Because he kept using that 44, even though it had been, you know, in the papers, he kept using it. And he seemed really delighted when he finally did get caught. So there's a weird creepiness to that. And they built that up, I think, really nicely by giving us those escalations. You know, when he starts to go outside of his regular pattern, when he kills a blonde woman instead of a brunette, when he goes to Brooklyn instead
right,
of where
when
he had
goes
been
to
previously.
Brooklyn. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, those are escalations in this story, and they're right there. And the thing is that when you're telling a story from truth, it's hard to manipulate it the way that you can with fiction, you know? And so they're actually using the natural escalations that happen with serial killers, especially ones of this particular type that do have this desire to play with the police, to get caught, to tell their story, right? They want to be heard. They want to be seen.
And you know, that's
they
their want the conflict, attention. Basically,
yes.
In their own narrative is like, I want to get away with it, but I also want credit for having gotten away with it, which I can't get unless I don't get away with it.
Exactly.
So
and it's playing
tension.
Back and forth with that. There's always that tension. And it's that playing back and forth. And then the natural narrative that comes from, you know, a cop, a good guy trying to take down a serial killer, a bad guy, like that natural narrative is right there. And so that these guys that hunt for a killer, they did that really, really well for the most part. But then they went overboard in some of those places. And I'm like, oh, man, you had it. You had it in your hands and you just let it drop.
And they were doing so much better than these things usually do that this was like an hour and 20 minutes on the screener that we saw. And there really wasn't a lot of like they would go to the ad break and there would be a very quick like just a reminder. Here's where we are in the story. This network is notorious for like just repeating the last 3 minutes from before the last ad break. Like do you just think everyone's in a waiting room? Like we know we're just here. We're with you.
I know there was a commercial break. I just saw, you know, a couple of commercials for laundry detergent and dog food, but I do remember what happened with the Son of Sam.
We fast forwarded. And they're not the only ones who do this. Of course, 48 hours does it. Dateline does it. I mean, they all do it. And I was impressed that this did not do it as much as you would expect from this network. But I was also, that clip also had a great, like that quote about the detective work. That's like, well, now we're screwed. Like we understand that Beam is doing what he's going to do. But first of all, he's going to create a panic.
Right.
And second of all, he's put the killer on notice. Like the one piece of evidence that we can use, you can now.
Yeah, that's going to give us anything for this guy because he's randomly killing people. And that is the hardest kind of person to catch because you can't follow the connections, you know?
And
so,
fortunately, he, first of all, got a parking ticket. And second of all, was haranguing Jimmy Breslin, which, was like, okay. But then I also loved, I don't know if you watched OJ Made in America, but this detective that we're about to hear in clip four sounded a lot like Detective Van Adder from the OJ case in a way that like, I don't like Van Adder as a person. Like I think he actually screwed up a lot of things and was emblematic of a lot of LAPD's problems from that time and so on and so forth. But he sounds authoritative and like real murder police, as they would say in Baltimore. And this guy's voice is very similar. And also this clip just made me laugh that he's like, don't put tips out like this that are totally not helpful. But it was amusing to me in clip four.
One of the psychiatrists I was interviewed said, the Son of Sam is probably impotent because of the gun and all. You know how many calls we got to the task force office? Women giving up impotent guys. I mean, it was unbelievable.
I don't know how many. Please give me an actual number because I think that's really, I think that would be really good information. Just like the following, whatever, 418 area housewives and girlfriends were like, it could be him.
Yeah, you know, I mean, honestly, I'm looking at
him. He's kind of a dick lately, and also exactly. He's really mad at the dog. I don't know.
So maybe he's the son of Sam. I don't know. I thought that was, I mean, it was one of those things where I laughed so hard at that moment, and I felt kind of bad about it because this is like very, like, you know, this is a really horrible story, and horrible things happened to people, and the city was terrorized, and, you know, New York in the 70s was not a fun place anyway, but when exactly. You've got like a serial killer out there, you know, but this whole moment I thought was really beautifully executed. And that's one of the things I think that made like the weird, you know, Son of Sam voiceover and the little things that they didn't do as well drove me nuts, because I love the quirkiness of that one moment in there, you know, and whoever, you know, produced this, I think has a very, very good sense of how to build a narrative and how to tell these stories and how to get your characters to really speak. Because even though they're real people, as far as building the narrative goes, they're characters, you know? And when you get the character from that guy where he's like, yeah, everybody was giving up their impotent husband at that point, you know?
He's still really a little great. Bent out of shape about it, which is an interesting, like, now that we're talking about it from a narrative building perspective, which is one of the many reasons I wanted to have you on at the pod, that there is this, in much true crime programming, there is this like benefit of hindsight assumption.
Yeah.
On the part of everyone that they're not even aware of. I don't think people are conscious of like, well, we know how this turns out. And of course you do. But this show was really good at getting expert like testimony and firsthand storytelling from people who were there, and then locating it at the time and getting them to make you feel like, well, you know, we do know how this turned out. Berkowitz is in prison. He is a Christian, son of hope, whatever.
Yes.
But they don't cheat that. Like they're to the talking head interviews for the most part, don't cheat that. And certainly going back to that clip we heard of Michael Loria, the brother of one of the victims.
Oh yeah.
I think it did an excellent job of not making it seem quite so far away as these things can seem, especially at this distance. So
yeah,
I'd recommend this one. I did not expect to. I thought it was just going to be like, well, I'll just do my toenails and then it'll be done. But I was impressed. It's good. Solid B+.
Yeah, no, I thought it was really well done. There were a couple of stumbles, but they also, like, whoever was doing the interviewing had this great way of getting these people to really connect with what they were talking about. And knowing how something ends, I mean, we have this, you know, fetishization with the surprise and with the twist. And whenever you're going into documentary, especially in a story that's this famous, like, everybody knows how it ends. But it's never about how the story ends. It's never about that unexpected ending. Every story is about the moments and how it builds and how it talks about whatever it is that it's talking about. And every story is talking about something greater. You know, I mean, this was a very particular thing that happened at a very particular time in New York City history. And I mean, this event, this summer of the Son of Sam, you know, that terrorizing that went through the city during a time in which there was so much unrest. I mean, New York was so crime ridden. There was so much stuff happening, so many murders happening, that it took them a while to even figure out that this stuff was related, because so many people were just getting killed all over the place, that it was just in there with everything else.
And this is
also
sort of at the beginning of any understanding of serial killers as like their own discrete thing that has to be tracked and followed up a different way. Like this is sort of, you know, at around the same time as Ted Bundy, where the fact that they even thought to call it a serial killer and link it together was a pretty new thing that even 5 years before you probably wouldn't have seen. So they were really up against it. The city was out of money. I mean, it was tough.
It was a
and
very
they did a good job of putting
experience.
Me back there. And you
yeah,
know,
they did
not, but not being too nostalgic about it. And it is a very like New York story. I mean, I tried to find a way or like an excuse to get Summer of Sam into my purview for this podcast. I just couldn't do it because I would love to talk to you about that. But that did a great job of giving you that flavor. And so actually, I thought, does the Lost Tapes generally? I like the way, well, let me just play our little cue here. It's two Most Wanteds. The Lost Tapes, have you watched anything else from this series?
I haven't, actually. And I found it really interesting that we're relying solely on primary sources, that it's material from the time. And we do have these little, you know, graphics that kind of give us a little bit of narration, a little bit of context. But for the most part, we're just looking at clips. And a lot of the clips that were in the Lost Tapes were used in Hunt for a Killer. So it's really interesting to watch both of these together.
Yeah, I was a little surprised that ID had it together enough to have that much of an overlap, which was cool. The Lost Tapes, generally, I like this sort of like found footage approach.
Yeah,
it's what I liked about that 30 for 30 episode about June 17th, 1994, which was like this perfect storm of sports stuff, including OJ's low speed chase. But he also used only primary sources, and like there was a little bit of dramatic music. But what's funny is that sometimes the primary sources undercut themselves
instead of
the Lost Tapes doing it. Like, let's listen to clip five and then talk about certain signifiers that we really don't need anymore.
Exactly that attracts people here. All that one can be absolutely sure of is that it isn't the conversation.
I mean, I understand that there was a time when Studio 54 really was the shit, and not this kind of like place that you would actually find pieces of in the Smithsonian. I guess I should mention, The Lost Tapes is a Smithsonian Channel property. This has already aired as you're listening to this, but I checked the TV Guide schedule and it is going to be re-airing in the next few days. So if you would like to check it out, set your DVRs. If you only have like 42 minutes to give to this story, this property is your boy. But yeah, like, we don't actually need even 1 second of public domain disco. Like, just get into it. Like, we know what the 70s were.
Yeah, it takes them a long time to get there. I mean, there was a point in my notes where I'm like, so you're saying New York was crime ridden in the 70s? I feel like we haven't made that clear. Because seriously, that's like the first 10, 15 minutes of the thing.
There was, yeah. And there was also like, I found it interesting, and it sort of brought me back, like having grown up near New York, like some of these things, like the old cop cars that they were phasing them out by the time you get to like the Law and Order credits in 1990, the old yellow street signs and how just vile and exciting, but vile everything was in Midtown.
Oh yeah.
And, but then they spend like a full 3 minutes on this like street fight and all this like peas and carrotsing. I mean, I know this actually happened, but I was like literally saying out loud rhubarb while I was watching it. I tried to clip it because it was like good flavor, but also like, all right, just make the Lost Tapes about this year in the city generally, and don't, but if it's going to be about Son of Sam, you need to like you're on the clock. Let's go.
You need to tell your story walking, dude. Yeah. Like, I mean, we're doing so much stuff here and spending all of this time, like, establishing what New York was like in the 70s. And plus the fact that, like, everything that they did from that point forward also established that. So you can, and this is something I tell people when I'm telling them about fiction, is tell your story walking. You can establish and tell your story at the same time. And I felt like we were in this, you know, 1970s, you know, time capsule of this is what it was like in the 70s. And I'm like, everything else that you have from these, you know, from these recordings, from these, you know, primary sources, which are very cool because you're seeing exactly what was going on at the time. It's not being reframed or contextualized through a modern, you know, vision of what it was like. These people were living in it. And when they did all these interviews with the young girls, I found fascinating, you know,
that,
these like young
that
women.
Is great. Actually, I did clip that. So let's hear clip six.
Okay.
I'm Jeff Kamen from Channel 11 News. Do you feel personally threatened by the .44 caliber killer because you have long brown hair?
No, not at all. Uh-uh. I'm afraid. I'm afraid to go out in the car. I'm afraid to do anything. Never know where he's going to be.
Have you ever thought of cutting your hair or wearing it up because of this guy?
No.
Did you ever think of cutting your hair because of him?
No, I never thought of going to that extent of it. I just don't want to be recognized. I thought of maybe dyeing it a little redder or something, really.
I mean, she sounds exactly like Stephanie from Saturday Night Fever. And B, I mean, I just, those accents, like, you know.
Oh, it's so of a time and place.
I mean, I live in Bay Ridge and you still hear it around a little, but like, that's a dying breed, that accent.
It was a different time. Like, it was a different place, you know? I mean, you look at it, like, I didn't really get to know the city. I mean, I lived upstate. I grew up like around Albany area, like in there. So, I mean, we went down to the city on occasion, but like never until I was older. And at that point, it was almost Rudy Giuliani time, where suddenly, you know, 46th Street or 42nd Street was no longer all, you know, strip clubs and porn places or whatever, you know? And everything just kind of changed and it became kind of Disney Santa, you know, which was a fascinating thing. And I would argue that the summer of the Son of Sam contributed directly to that revolution, you know, that like law and order revolution in New York City, which had its ups and its downs.
This was like rock bottom.
Yeah. This was, I think, part of what made that happen. So the thing that I really enjoyed about the Lost Tapes is that it is this moment in time sort of frozen, and you watch all this. And I mean, I have a background in television production and I've worked in some broadcast journalism. So for me, like, the fascinating thing was looking at how these broadcast journalists did their stand up when there was that guy who was doing the stand up next to like the drawing of the naked lady next to the thing, and then ends his stand up in just dead silence, turning and looking at her boobs, you know. And I was like, that is such a classic moment in time. Like, there are certain things that only happen in very particular moments in time. And it's an incredible thing to be able to watch that and to be able to kind of experience that history in a way that you and I were so young when this happened. We had no idea. So looking back on it now, it's like we remember the 70s vaguely, you know, but then to have that kind of, you know, that kind of context layered over it and it being purely a story that is told in its time and place, I thought that that was fascinating. I also really loved that we're watching the beginning of criminal profiling, right? I mean, this is one of the first criminal profiles, and the psychologist, the Schlossberg guy, right?
He was fabulous. You listen to him talk.
I know. But I mean, like in the 70s, what he's saying, he seems so unsure of himself. He's like, I don't know. He might be this. He might be that. Apparently he said he might be impotent. and he had like all this stuff about, you know, what kind of person he is and all that. And then when, you know, from the Hunt for a Killer, the first one we talked about, where they had him now talking so much more securely in his profiling language.
Much more confident. And he's like the emeritus of this. Sure.
Yeah, it was fascinating for me just to kind of see that slice of history. So, you know, for me, like, there are so many things about the Lost Tapes, you know, about this approach to telling these stories that, while I think it wasn't as effective as the first one, as The Hunt for the Killer, there's something about going into these archives and that found footage sort of feeling to it that puts you very much in that time and place. There isn't that distance, that contextualizing for it. And I thought that was kind of fascinating.
Well, and you're also seeing yet another case, along with the Zodiac, which we'll be talking a little bit more about next week, of the story becoming the story.
Oh, yeah.
And the reporter becoming the story, and the killer sort of determining when the storyteller enters the story. And here, of course, it was Jimmy Breslin. They don't do a lot to put him in context, but here in the Lost Tapes, but in Hunt for a Killer, they do talk quite a bit about how he was the columnist. People would buy the paper just to read him, and that's why Berkowitz picked him, because it's like, if I want the biggest possible mouth in a city full of them, we have to go with Breslin. You called for our next clip, which is Jimmy Breslin talking about this experience, which, when he seems disconcerted, you know, it's a big deal. Do you have anything you want to say leading up before I play the clip?
No, I'll talk about it afterward, because there's something really interesting about this interaction.
Okay.
The letter was very eerie. I mean, you know, then you know that he read something that you wrote. Somewhere out there, he's reading again what you wrote. It's one of those crimes that's been visited upon man throughout the ages. The demented killer, and you don't know how to stop him.
Yeah, what I loved about this.
What an interesting comment at the end that he's like, this is just a part of the fabric of human history. And I'm like, well, no. Yeah, but wow,
yeah,
like you're bringing
this,
that up? Like, okay.
He's creating this massive narrative. Like, he is becoming part of the story. And you can see that in him. I mean, this is, you know, he's like, I wrote this. He read it. I know that he's out there reading what I wrote. He knows that he's being folded into the fabric of this narrative, and he's actually folding himself in because now he's framing himself as the protagonist of the story. You know, it's one of these things, this classic story. It's been told since the beginning of time. You know, you got a crazy guy out there and you don't know how to stop him. You know, I mean, he's
making
observer.
Himself part of law enforcement
as
well.
Yes. He's right, because his
like,
job isn't
the,
to stop
the
this guy.
Is really, I don't know how to stop him. And then they show a lot of his headlines that are like,
yeah. Give up now.
Yeah,
he's telling him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Turn yourself
and
in.
I thought that was just like, because the thing is that like, there's this thing with the human brain, right? That we love narrative, that we are actually geared to take patterns, any kind of pattern and give them meaning. And narrative story is basically just a pattern of events with meaning, right? So when you get into something like this, you know, it becomes this huge story, this huge narrative. And for the person who is observing, you know, who is telling this story, usually they're just on the sidelines writing down what happens. But then you got Jimmy Breslin, who gets these letters personally, who is being folded into that narrative by David Berkowitz, who, by the way, is telling his own narrative from his, all of his letters are pure, you know, I'm creating a narrative. I'm explaining to you what the context and the meaning of all of this is, you know? And so
and occasionally
for me,
I'm giving you like next ons and spoilers.
Yeah,
too,
exactly.
Like,
I'm telling
yeah.
you where it's going to be and what's going to happen. And, you know, July 29th and all this kind of stuff.
Like his idea of serial yeah. killer is also like serialized storytelling.
Oh,
in some
absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, even
these
if you believe
chapters.
That he's insane, which
well,
I don't.
I mean,
I'm not
yeah.
sure about that whole dog story. I'm sure he killed the dog. I just don't think it was talking
I
to
think,
him.
Right. I think that there is a certain amount of insanity that has to happen for you to be able to do this to another human being, for you to be able to do these things. I think that you do have to have, like, for me, I feel like there's a certain amount of insanity that just goes with that. But like,
oh,
again,
yeah,
where
absolutely.
You define.
I just
right,
am not
whether,
sure
whether he
that
actually
the dog
believed
story,
that the dog.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy that.
I don't think
but
I buy that either.
It was a good yeah. story. We're still
but
talking
it was
about
interesting.
It.
Yeah. And I mean, it's one of those things, right? You know, the dog tells you to kill. Like, it's one of those things that we've gone back to in our pop culture so many times to kind of revisit what that means and tease that out. But I love this use of this narrative. And we had a couple of things, and I didn't call for them, but I kind of wish that I had a couple of clips from Geraldo Rivera in his early, early super mustached days
yeah,
of reporting.
I think it was shortly after Willowbrook. I mean,
oh yeah,
this,
we got
this
a drama.
Guy. Yeah.
That guy, I mean, he's so blatantly like working the drama and in the way that he expresses everything and the way that he talks about it. But for me, like that was fascinating because Geraldo Rivera is classic for inserting himself. Like David Berkowitz kind of pulled Breslin into it, and Breslin was a willing dance partner. I'm definitely going to say that, you know. But Geraldo Rivera was like begging Berkowitz to send him a letter. He just like, you know,
yeah.
that's what he wanted
well, and
more
Breslin
than anything.
Breslin is like old school ink stained. Mm-hmm. Wretch tabloid guy.
Yeah.
And Geraldo, I mean, I would invite you to try to get anything between Geraldo's skin and his shirt. You can't.
Oh, yes.
It's way too tight. And I'm not even complaining. Like, Geraldo Rivera, right. like, I don't think I would cross the street to put him out if he were on fire. He's pretty gross, but.
He's a fascinating person, yeah. though. Like, to
I
watch him
if he didn't
work.
Talk.
Yeah, no, watching him work, his talking is what I like. To me, it's fascinating. Like,
I mean,
it's
charisma
it's
for days,
gross
that
and disturbing.
Guy, but ugh.
Yeah, it's gross and disturbing, and it's blatantly manipulative. You know, I mean, like, there's a lot about Geraldo Rivera that's very disturbing, but from like a psychological point of view, he's fascinating. And he was coming up during this celebrity journalist place, and that's what he ended up becoming, was the celebrity journalist, you know,
yeah.
where it became as much about him as it was about whatever it was that he was covering. Whereas your classic old school journalist was like, I'm sitting back with my cigar and I'm telling this story, you know? And that's the kind of guy that Jimmy Breslin was, but then he was pulled into that narrative and it's so seductive. And you can see how seductive that narrative is when he's talking about it. And to me, you know, being a narrative girl, being a story nerd, you know, that just pulled me in immediately. I was like, oh my God, that's so, it's so neat and crunchy how that happens.
And that's another sort of transitional phase that we as a culture were in as to how we were getting our nonfiction narrative. And then at the end of it, you have David Berkowitz himself, who they don't have a ton of him in the Lost Tapes, but there is some. And even though he was crafting this narrative at the end, it was completely like it was just random id, which is what defines these guys and makes them so scary. So let's hear clip 8.
And I had nothing against these victims. Who were these people to me? They were just people. I didn't hate them. I wasn't angry against them.
Who was it doing?
Well, Sam did it through me. He used me. He made me go out there and do it. I did it for him, for blood.
You did it for attention. You did it so you could tell this story. And if that's the motive, like, well done, I guess. Like, you still have everyone's attention 40 years later.
Oh, yeah. And
which
I mean,
is
the
really
attention
unfortunate.
Is what
and I think the victims, I think what The Hunt for a Killer does really well is remind you, like, as fascinating as Berkowitz's construction of this situation and this trail is, dozens of lives were left in shambles. So I think that's an important thing to, I think sometimes true crime programs can be a little, you know, the fact is narratively when you're telling stories of true crimes and especially murders, it can be difficult to keep the victims front of mind because they exit the story as a way of starting the story. So,
well, right. And in our narratives.
Yeah.
Yeah. In our narratives in general, like the victims only serve to be the bad thing that the killer does. It's always about the killer. I mean, you think about, we know Ted Bundy. Do we know the names of his victims? No. You know, not unless you really know the story, you don't usually know the names of the victims. And I do think that they did a good job in The Hunt for a Killer, definitely of connecting us with these people whose lives had been so seriously affected. We had Robert Violante, right, who had been shot and lost his eyesight with Stacey Moskowitz, right? And we see him and we, you know, hear his story from, you know, looking back on it from 40 years later, you know, and his experience of it. And I think that talking directly to the victims and having that connection, I think, and we don't spend a whole lot of time on Berkowitz in any of these properties. You know, we do spend more time like thinking about the victims and building that up. But I think the Lost Tapes doesn't do that quite as well as Hunt for a Killer.
And they just may not have had as much time. And if they're trying to use found footage and stuff that we haven't
You've
seen
only
a million
got
times,
so much.
Then then you sort of run out of time. But there is something about his like blithe eagerness to talk about the fact that it wasn't a grudge. He didn't hate any of these people.
Right.
And then he's like, so why'd you do it? And there's a pause and he's like, well, you know, Sam told me to do it.
Right. And that's
maybe,
the thing is that,
but I don't think so. I think you knew what would get you in the paper and get you a nickname. And you were right.
Right. He wants all the attention from it, but he doesn't want to take responsibility for it. So he's blaming it on somebody else. I mean, it's a classic, like psychologically, you know, he's fascinating. And it's kind of like that classic. It's like, I want this part of this experience, but I don't want the other part of this experience. So I'm going to try to manipulate this story so that I can, you know, I can blame it on somebody else. You know, the dog made me do it.
I
could
be a victim too, but this time of mental illness or what have you.
Right. But he took so much joy. He was so happy. Like when you see him getting arrested and he is smiling and he is so pleased. I mean, this is what he wanted. You know, he wanted that attention. He wanted that fame. And, you know, and that too is kind of a creepy humanity disconnect. You know, that like there is this, I think there is this deep human need to be seen, to be noticed, you know, and a lot of people look at that as they want fame. You know, a lot of people go out and chase that kind of fame, you know, and he did it in a way that got him so much attention and got him so much fame and so much attention. I think that it really fed something deep within him that needed to be seen in that way and give him that platform. But then when it came right down to it, you know, he couldn't follow through with the rest of that, which is taking responsibility and saying, yeah, I did this thing, you know, instead making, it was, I have to blame it on somebody else.
Yeah. Or making connections in any other meaningful way, except this extremely, you know, this lethal, melodramatic meta way that he chose, because he has to have tried other, you know, other ways of connecting with people. But as you so often see, in these stories, they just can't. And there's a series of like abandonments and rejections and so on. You know where you don't, I mean, actually, that's not true. As we move to our cold case. for a TV movie about the Son of Sam, it spends a shockingly small amount of time on the Son of Sam, but it does have that moment where the guy playing David Berkowitz, like, he asks the detectives to like comb his hair before they perp walk him into the precinct. But it was like, I don't think that's going to help. But also, where have you been? This is seriously the last 3 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
I was really delighted when you agreed to come on to find Jed Bartlett starring in this thing.
Jed Bartlett. I know.
It was just kind of a who cares, or like, I mean,
it was so bad. It was fascinating to me. Like I was so entranced with, because, you know, we were talking about like this really strong narrative, you know, that we got in The Hunt for a Killer. And then this really kind of interesting, different take on that narrative, this found footage in the moment sort of take on the narrative, you know, from the Lost Tapes. And then we go into Out of Darkness, which is a narrative fever dream. There is no story going on here. There's nothing, like everything that's happening has nothing to do with anything. We have this, you know, this detective, and he's sort of interested in like finding the Son of Sam, but he's not really invested, you know. He's got this wife who's sick, he's got this daughter with long brown hair, you know, and so you think, oh, they're gonna kill the daughter, because they obviously have to motivate him to want to, you know, I mean, they, you know, I had this expectation they were gonna fridge the daughter. They didn't even do that, you know. It was just this weird, and he's talking to his priest and at the aquarium looking at sharks. It is so weird and so strange, and almost nothing to do with the Son of Sam at all. The only thing we see is that throughout the movie, every now and again, we see some guy who apparently really hates car windows, because we just see the gun and the car window exploding. Like, that's all.
Yeah, actually, that's the first thing we see, in which DB Topic Sweeney,
oh, I know,
is making out with his date and gets iced by the window hater. Cut to, and then you think you're sort of jumping right into it from a task force perspective. Little do you know that Out of the Darkness appears to refer to Mrs. Martin Sheen's mitral valve.
Yes. Which is crazy, because there's no narrative going on here. Like, the whole point of like when you tell a story, and especially when you're doing a fictionalized thing, like they're not clearly sticking to all of everything exactly the way that it happened. They're fictionalizing this story, which means they have a little bit more literary license there. They can do a little bit more. But I mean, you're supposed to have a protagonist with a goal and an antagonist who's blocking that goal, right? And we have Martin Sheen, who is, you know, kind of like, he's at work and he's sort of asking questions about it, but he's going down a million false leads. Like, nothing is leading anywhere. He's not putting anything together. He's not building, you know, a case. And he gets asked to be on the task force, he's a hostage negotiator,
which we see
apparently. And I love that he uses a kid.
I'm not sure how long that went on. God.
He uses a kid. Did you see that part though? He's like, well, you got to get a kid who knows the building. And he brings the kid over. Like, he puts on this whole like bulletproof vest and all this stuff. And then he brings this little kid with him. And I'm like, does the kid get a vest? You know, does the kid's mother get like some say in the fact that you're bringing this kid into a hostage situation?
That's not the only kid who gets sucked into an interminable scene. But first, let's talk about how almost everyone you've ever heard of is in this movie at some point. point, starting yes. with clip 9. Sam McMurray, take it away with the exposition.
Sounds like a reasonable young man.
The city's gonna need a straitjacket.
Everybody I know is cutting their hair because of those rumors Son of Sam kills when he sees long hair.
Yeah, try to get a date.
Oh, he never could anyway.
How do you figure this guy anyway?
You don't, he's a psycho.
Oh, end of movie then. By the way, Sam McMurray, Martin Sheen, and in the background of this scene, but his single line does not come later, is Eric LaSalle.
Uh-huh.
We also have D.B. Sweeney, the priest.
Oh, Hector Elizondo.
Yes,
I know.
Looking
yeah.
so young and with so much hair and with those
I know.
Delightfully huge glasses. And apparently access to the like release valves at the local aquarium.
What? I'm guessing. Well, he's a priest. If you're going to trust anybody with your release valves, it should be a priest, right?
I guess. And then there's a whole side thing about like they get into he and his partner, Martin Sheen, uh-huh. get into a scrap with some victims' parents at the hospital. And I guess this guy is a connected guy. You called for clip 10. Shall we listen to it? And then you can give me your theory as to what the hell this clip is even doing in the movie.
Yes.
All right. You may not have a theory, but come up with one. Here's clip okay. 10.
You had a lot to say to me at the hospital, and nobody talks to me like that. I don't give a damn who they think they are. And the only thing keeping me from knocking you off that bar stool is my father taught me to respect old men. Talk like a tough guy. I'm as tough as I have to be.
Ooh.
All right, I'm going to tell you why I called for that.
I mean, my theory is yeah. that my theory on why you called for it is that uh-huh. the way he rushed through that speech and then had to take uh-huh. a little breath at the end was like his audition for Sorkin.
Oh, yes, exactly.
As to what it's doing in the movie, I have no idea. Maybe Martin Sheen's agent was like, you got to make him look like a guy who can talk to anybody, but is tough, which who cares? Anyway,
I guess. What is your
hypothesis here?
Well, here's the thing. Like, you know, we're here to talk about Son of Sam, but this movie is not doing anything with Son of Sam. It is just no. Martin Sheen wandering around in various circumstances, you know? And the thing that I loved about this is how dreadful that dialogue is. Like that it is no, have I displeased you, you feckless thug. It is no Sorkin going on here, right? This is so unbelievably bad that it kind of like, remember E.T. was uh-huh. so ugly that it curved the corner into kind of cute and adorable.
Right.
Like this is such bad dialogue that it kind of curves the corner into fascinating. Like it is fascinatingly bad. And when I heard that exchange between these two, I mean, first of all, you know, they're in the middle of the hospital. This guy's son has just died. And I don't care how connected he is or what kind of rivalries you have. His son just died. And Martin Sheen throws him up against the wall and like, you're not going to talk to me like that. And then goes into the thing, says, nobody
while
talks
his,
to me
while
that
his
way.
Mom is crossing herself like grandma.
Exactly.
Like Nona
exactly.
is out in the hallway like, ay. Like, uh-huh.
Nona's used to this shit. Let me tell you.
You said a mouthful, ma'am.
It was just to me, it was like this beautiful moment of I don't even care. I'm getting paid. It was just that's what the subtext was for every scene with Martin Sheen and Hector Elizondo. Like no matter what they were saying, what I heard was you got paid for this, didn't you? Yeah, I got paid for this. Yep. I got paid for
check,
this, too. I'm putting in a
cleared.
Pool in the back. Exactly. Like the check cleared. So I'm just going to be here and I'm going to say this terrible dialogue while we look at a shark and it's all weird. And, you know, and so that was
I
the
know,
stuff.
This
that,
stakeout sequence with the kid who actually brought their coffees to the car has been going on since God was a boy. But I got nowhere else to be. So let's just drag it out for another week.
And there's no narrative happening here.
No.
There's no anything. We're getting like sometimes we got the deal with his wife and her mitral valve and her like, you know, heart problems and all that kind of stuff. Who, by the way, like I looked up the actress. She was 31 when she played that role. And he was like, we've been married for 24 years. Or she was 41, I think maybe. We've been married
oh,
for 24 years. And I was like, okay, this isn't right. Like, this is just like, that's just weird. Like, she should not be that young playing that role.
And then
you
the
know,
kids
especially,
have to, like, he just decides to be on the task force because there's a
yeah.
hiring freeze and he could be promoted. And then he's somewhere all night task
yeah.
forcing. And then his kids are like, how you always called mom? This is different. You always called mom. This is different. You always call. Oh my God. Yeah. Like,
let's run around that mulberry bush one more time. Yeah.
Also, what movie are y'all in? Because I wanted to see a film about David Berkowitz and his capture.
Yeah, no,
this
and we get
is
nothing
not that, and also
until the last few minutes, and he's a terrible freaking detective too, because he can't put anything together.
No,
everything is a wild goose chase. Everything is like, oh, I'm gonna look at this person in a yellow van. Oh, it's a woman. Okay, we know women can't shoot guns, so let's let her go. You know, I mean, I can't with the whole thing. It was so incredibly like.
And then he tells everyone that he's like, you idiot, is always his tone. I'm just going to play the last clip, which is like, I had to play that back that I'm like, why does she want this? Because he's a moron in this moment.
That's exactly why I wanted it. It's hilarious.
My people. Here we go. Clip 11.
I'm thinking about Delilah and Samson. Sam's son.
Yeah, there you go. That's some tight dialogue.
Word. And then his partner's like, huh. Like,
yeah.
He just told him what the weather was going to be. Like, so are you going to, like, this is where I would have actually liked a little handholding, because even though he's full of shit, it's like, are you talking about long hair?
Right. They undercut his capability at every possible turn, which is the opposite of what you're supposed to do with a character, unless you're arcing them from incapability to capability, in which case you're doing something deliberate and okay, fine. But in this, we're trying to show how tough he is and how smart he is and what a good cop he is. And he's just passively bouncing from thought to thought, like he's on some kind of crazy mushroom trip. You know, and it just, none of it's connected. None of it makes any sense. We have this moment. I'm talking about Delilah and Samson, you know, Sam's son, wink, wink. And that has absolutely bugger all to do with anything.
Yeah.
This is the moment where this would be the big like reveal that like his brilliance would make this connection.
And then
David
he goes
Berkowitz.
To the crazy wall with the yarn and the pins and he sorts it out. We have a montage like, okay, it's been done, but it's been done for a reason. It's so that we can move this forward towards the climax. I have to wonder, because this is not quite like any other TV movie that I've watched for The Blotter Presents before, which often can be like laborious, overacted, you know, the end. There's a lot of like footage of people walking into buildings, which is like, all right, you got to fill out 3 hours. I get it. But this one is very, usually it's like based on a book or there's a consultant like this. I really think someone was like, we want to do a TV movie about Son of Sam. And the network was like, it, you know, there's too much Son of Sam in your Son of Sam movie. Can you insert an entire secondary plot that will metastasize and take over?
And accomplish nothing. Like nothing happens in the other plots either. Like nothing happens in any of this. This is one of these things. Like there are some people who think that story is just something happens and then something happens and then something else happens and then things stop happening. And that's not how story works. But that's like what people kind of think. And so like you get some movies that somehow get the green light regardless, because it's like, you know, the Son of Sam. But the thing is that like there's in this, you know, hour and a half of movie, because there's a TV movie and there were like, you know, commercial breaks and everything. It's like an hour and a half of movie in which I would say maximum 7 minutes is Son of Sam. Like, you know, everything else is like him wandering around, you know, and like we don't even get like one of the things that happens in actual reality is that this guy, you know, Son of Sam is taunting the detective and he's sending letters to the detective. Why did we not have Son of Sam actually taunting and being an active antagonist for this detective? In that case, you've got a story because you've got the guy who's taunting and actually has a relationship with your protagonist. These guys meet up a little bit at the end and Martin Sheen is like, well, you know, they don't believe that you're the crazy guy who killed all these people, you know, and I have to get the proof. And he like tricks him into telling him where the gun is, you know, and the guy's like, it's in my car, you know.
Yeah,
I don't even know what is that. What kind of cop doesn't look in somebody's car? Like, what is that?
You'd been staking out the car, yeah, and then the whole having just watched like 3 other hours of actually decent footage of this, like,
yeah,
then you know that this stakeout and him sort of like wandering to all four corners of the intersection and then like skipping down the street while rolling a hoop or whatever the fuck was going on. It's not what happened. What happened was actually plenty compelling because, weirdly, the killer made sure of it. So,
yeah. No, I mean, they built a narrative in real life. Why not use that in your fiction? You don't usually get that. You don't usually get a narrative that is that neatly composed, you know, from reality. You usually have to massage it a bit for these docudramas. But the idea that they had a narrative that had been built by people who understood narrative and pulled it out. I mean, you know, Berkowitz is nuts, but the man knew how to tell a story. He really did. He knew how to build this thing, you know, even if that was just an instinctual thing. And they had, you know, the taunting of the police and the taunting of the press and working with the press. There were so many things that could have been done to make this, you know, fictionalized narrative of reality actually work. But they ignored all the parts of reality that were actually building into a really quality narrative and just went nuts on stuff that doesn't matter. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't that interested in the sharks. I'm like, first of all, when we were at the shark tank the first time, I was like, all right, whatever. When we go back to it again, like, why are we back at the shark tank? Like, what is this? And he just would sit there and have a conversation with his priest.
Doy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I supposed to? That's supposed to make sense to me.
I don't know.
Obviously, I missed the greater symbolism there.
Also,
but
I don't think they actually do. So it's like, if you're going to use something in, I don't know, symbolic, right, try not picking something that your average 5-year-old will be like, sharks stick to themselves. I mean, I don't
exactly
know. That's true. Don't
They're
at me
loner
about sharks.
Predators. I have no idea.
Yeah, I really don't know either. Like, hey,
but regardless,
all y'all shark
I'm pretty
listeners
sure it's
out
not
there,
working for you.
Yeah, let us know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
There was
it's
also
crazy.
This cool, like, opportunity that they missed because you sort of forget where, like, when you are in life until you're sitting through yet another interminable doctor's appointment scene. And she's being told that she really can't, like, she can sort of go to the kitchen and get a snack if she's on the same floor as the kitchen, but no stairs and no going to work. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, what about work? And he's like, oh, right, I forgot you work. Like, I mean, here in 2017, everyone works. But in a 1985 movie set in 1977, it was like, oh, you work. Like, like on a cop salary, everybody's working, even the kids.
Right.
So that was sort of funny. But then it made me think, like, I was just making notes about what a cool movie it would have been if she's on total bed rest, just waiting for this procedure. That they can code crack it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that couple did the cracked Zodiac cipher, that it's like, have it be an activity.
Oh, yeah, that she could have been part of that could have been a reason to have her bedridden or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, like there's no reason to have this story with his wife. And they have his daughter who has brown hair.
Yeah.
Right.
And then they just kill her off. And it's like, it's not like he's cracking the case to avenge her because she wasn't killed by Son of Sam.
She has nothing to do with Son of Sam. You know, like none of it has anything to do with anything. And they go through this whole scene with the doctor where she's like, you need to be my surgeon. And he's like, well, you know, I might be playing golf that day and who knows. And then she's like, no, I'm not going to do it unless. And they go through this whole thing. And then he's not her surgeon because they rescheduled. And then Martin Sheen freaks out and throws him up against the wall. And I'm like, none of this has anything to do with Son of Sam. Like you can have subplots in a story. But the whole point of a subplot is that it builds into the main plot, that it like supports the main plot, that you don't go off on this complete weird tangent, which is actually more of the movie than the Son of Sam stuff.
Oh yeah,
which is
easily.
Nothing, you know. Yeah, it's so insane. And the thing is that like it was truly awful. I mean, it was really, really bad, but like bad in a way that I'm glad I watched it. Like it was an experience to watch this thing and to have this like this crazy fever dream
of
a docudrama.
I thought it was going to be bad in this kind of standard way that these things are always
was very special in a bad.
Yeah,
this is very bad in a special way.
Yeah. But then I thought it was like once I was 20 minutes into it and I was like, why has literally nothing happened so far?
Yeah.
That I was like, well, at least maybe my guest can get some kind of like, you know, instructive, like perhaps you can use this in a class or be like, well, just case you think that it's possible to have a surrealist narrative in which nothing actually happens involving a serial killer, allow me to point you to Out of the Darkness.
I love it for so many reasons. I had a great time watching this. I mean, notes were so fun. Like, I just had so much fun, like, looking at this, because it is the most insane. Like, anybody who knows anything, even a little bit about storytelling, would not do this thing. So it was kind of fun to sort of watch it. It was fun to watch Martin Sheen and Hector Elizondo be like, I got paid. You get paid. I got paid. It's good. You know, let's pet a shark. It's just like, it's so crazy and weird. And I would honestly recommend it. I would recommend it with some sort of alcoholic beverage. I have to say, like, don't go into this thinking that you're going to be like, you know, like entranced with it, but just to watch it from the perspective of just fascination that this ever, ever made it to television, you know, like this ever got produced.
Crank the AC, make yourself a margarita. Craft a drinking game around it with a couple of friends. Like,
yes,
get a peanut gallery
going.
Have
some fun.
It is on YouTube, and you'll find it in our show notes. So before we wrap this up, listeners, I'm sure that you're interested in hearing more about proper narrative construction. So let's try to end on a positive note in that regard. Lonnie, where can listeners find you?
Listeners can find me at chipperish.com, which is where I have my media company. I have a podcast called How Story Works, where I do talk about how narrative functions. And so anything that you want to learn about narrative and about storytelling, go to Chipperish, go to How Story Works, and you can hear it all there.
And is your Buffy pod also on hiatus right now, or is that still going?
No, my Buffy pod is still on. I'm a huge Buffy fan. I think there's so much to be learned from Buffy, just both philosophically and as far as storytelling. That's still pretty. So that's both a video blog that I have on YouTube, and I also release it as a podcast. So I have that as well. And I'm also doing a podcast called Big Strong Yes, where me and Dr. Kelly Jones, who is my co-host, we are going through Brené Brown's Rising Strong, Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic, and Shonda Rhimes' Year of Yes, and pulling out life lessons. So you can find all sorts of interesting stuff over at Chipperish Media at chipperish.com.
And if you are a Go Pirates fan, our Veronica Mars podcast in the previously .tv suite of podcasts, in I think 8 to 9 weeks, we're sort of a little ahead in our drop cycle right now. But Lonnie will be joining us for episode 18 of season one. Is that right?
Wait.
Was that your pick? Yes.
I think that's my pick. I'll come in for any of them. I love Veronica Mars and I love Go Pirates. I think it's so fantastic. I listen every week.
Ah, thanks. Speaking of every week, coming up on The Blotter Presents, next week we'll be talking about the Zodiac. After that, there's yet another event series about Lacey Peterson. I think it might be time to let her rest, but no rest for the wicked over here. And a week after that, we'll be looking at the definitive take on Natalie Holloway. Who can say? Well, actually, my guests and I can say, and so can you. Please visit us on our forums at previously.tv/forums. You can shout at us on Twitter at Blotter Presents, and we're also on Facebook at Blotter Presents. I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation, and I will talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.